As always, I want to thank everyone who's been listening. I really appreciate your support. Thanks especially to those folks who've taken the time to rate the podcast and leave a review. It really helps new listeners find the show. This episode is pretty light on the gross factor, other than lots of references to cat feces. There is, however, some discussion of severe negative health outcomes for human infants, which may be disturbing for some listeners.
Well, I didn't let it in, but it drilled right through my skin. Then it traveled to my brain, which it caused to be inflamed. It finally nestled in my liver, gave me fever and a shiver. It was the worst guest ever.
Imagine that you're sitting on the couch drinking your morning coffee and scrolling through the news on your phone when you hear a familiar sound coming from the stairs down to the basement. You hear the unmistakable trilling meow signaling a victorious hunt. Oh no, you think. What did Mr. McWhiskers catch this time? He emerges from the basement, strutting towards you with a dead rodent in his mouth. Definitely dead, because it is missing its head. He is notoriously fond of beheadings, and you suspect he is consuming the heads before parading his trophies around the house. You plan to be extra careful when cleaning his litter box in the next few weeks because you suspect that he might have just consumed infectious cysts of toxoplasma from the brain of his prey. If so, he will soon be shedding oocysts in his feces, and you do not want to become another unwitting host for this notorious single-celled parasite. I'm Sam Messier, and this is Worst Guest Ever, a podcast dedicated to parasites and their hosts. I've been with my partner Anne since 1998, and she has one rule for me while socializing with friends and family. No talking about parasites while people are eating. This podcast is my excuse to break the rules. Each episode, I'll discuss a parasitic organism with one or more special guests who will be feasting on a meal that I've designed to represent the featured parasite in some way. In this episode, we'll be discussing the parasite Toxoplasma gondii, the causative agent of toxoplasmosis, a disease thought to affect roughly one-third of the humans alive on the planet today. My guests are Ben Messier, Tanya Messier, and Dawn Stafford. Welcome! I'm so excited to have you guys on here.
Yay.
Hello!
Thank you for having us so much.
Such a pleasure to have you guys. So this is our first road trip episode. We're actually coming to you from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, with this fabulous group of guests that I've invited on today. Do you guys want to just quickly introduce yourselves, say a little bit about yourselves?
Hi, I'm Dawn, and I am best friends with Sam and Anne and Ben and Tanya, and I'm excited to be here.
Hello, I'm Ben. I'm Sam's little brother. Tanya said younger brother.
Thank you for that clarification, Tanya.
Hi, I'm Tanya. I am Ben's wife, Sam, and Anne's sister-in-law.
So, I'm really excited to talk about this parasite with a group of dedicated cat lovers. I want to know, first of all, have any of your cats, past or present, ever managed to bring you a real rodent?
Yes, this is Dawn, and my cat loved to bring me lots of presents, especially mice. She was indoor-outdoor, and she frequently left me gifts of mice and lizards on my front porch.
Oh, nice. Yes. Lizards, too.
Yes, lots of mice and lots of lizards, and the occasional bird.
Uh-huh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Our cat, Crikey, used to bring squirrels. Mm.
That's a big takedown for a cat.
And birds.
Beheaded squirrels.
But your current cat only captures beanie babies.
That is correct.
He is indoor only.
Yeah. He is quite the hunter when it comes to beanie babies, though.
Yes. Yeah, I've seen this in action. So. And how do you guys feel about cleaning the cat's litter box?
I'm okay with it. I do it every 3 to 4 days. A couple times a week.
Yep. Yeah, I was okay with cleaning.
Well, now that I've learned that cat litter box is so delicious, I might have to start cleaning it more often.
Oh, excellent. And thank you, Ben, for alluding to our featured dish for today. So our meal this week is something I'm calling cat box casserole. I actually got the idea from a litter box cake that I saw on social media, and I thought, you know, I bet I could make a casserole that captures that same visual effect. So it's basically a Mexican-style comfort food casserole with tater tots, chicken, salsa verde, sautéed onion, garlic, and bell pepper, and cheddar cheese, covered in a layer of finely crushed tortilla chips that produce the litter effect. How does it look?
Oh, just like quite appetizing.
Very delicious.
Yeah. Doesn't look as appetizing as it tastes. It's delicious.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. So let's get started talking about our parasite, the single-celled organism Toxoplasma gondii. So it's a single-celled organism, but unlike bacteria or archaea, these cells have a nucleus and a pretty complicated set of intracellular organelles, just like animal or plant cells. And you might remember the names of some of these from biology class. Endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi apparatus, mitochondria. Is this sounding familiar?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So the Toxoplasma gondii also has a unique organelle that's not found in animals or plants. It's called a rope tree, which is a sort of club-shaped organelle that sits at one end of the cell, and it plays a role in helping the parasite invade its host. Another interesting aspect of Toxoplasma is that its cells change shape depending on what life stage they're in. Each life stage has a unique name and a unique shape. For example, in their bradyzoite stage, they basically look like little sandwich rolls with slightly pointed ends, you know, kind of like a hoagie roll. But, of course, they're translucent, and you can easily see the nucleus floating around in the cytoplasm. Not in the center, but kind of off towards one end. In the tachyzoite stage, the cell looks a little more pear-shaped. And in the sporozoite stage, it is more banana-shaped. I'll talk about what these different stages do in a little bit. I'm just trying to give you a sense of what they look like. The nucleus is actually pretty large. It takes up a big part of the cell, about a quarter of the space within the cell. Of course, the cells themselves are extremely small, about 4 to 6 micrometers long. And for reference, that is a little smaller than a human red blood cell. And the smallest particles that can be seen with the naked eye are about 40 to 50 micrometers long, so about 10 times as big. So Toxoplasma gondii has, like most parasites we get to talk about on this show, a rather complicated life cycle. But I like to start with that because I think the life cycle helps us understand its basic biology, and most importantly, how it reproduces. Because evolution favors traits that help an organism reproduce and leave more offspring. And we'll talk about some features of Toxoplasma in this episode that allow it to reproduce more successfully, some of which are a little spooky. I'm going to simplify the life cycle a little. So if you're a Toxoplasma gondii specialist, please cut me some slack, because the full description is 10 pages long, single-spaced. Now, if this gets confusing, don't hesitate to ask me to slow down. At each stage, we'll talk about where it's happening, in its primary or definitive host, which is a cat, in its secondary host, which is some other animal, or floating around in the environment. So let's start with a stage called the oocyst, which is like a fertilized egg encapsulated in a shell that protects it from the environment. So basically, you can think of it like an egg. The oocysts start their life inside a cat and are shed in the cat's feces into the environment. And by cat, I mean any member of the family Felidae. So various wild cat species such as tigers and lions, as well as domesticated cats. Yeah, can you imagine having to empty a tiger's litter box? That would be daunting. When the oocysts are first shed from the cat, they're not actually infectious yet. You can think of each of them as sort of an egg that's not ready to hatch. That's an imprecise analogy, but you kind of get the idea. They have to undergo a sporulation process, which is triggered by exposure to the air, where the egg divides twice to form four separate sporozoites still inside the shell. After those sporozoites form inside the oocyst, it is ready to hatch and capable of infecting a wide range of animals. It doesn't have to infect another animal right away, however. It can persist in the environment for a long time. So here's a tip based on toxoplasma biology. If you get rid of your cat's poop from the litter box right away and don't let it sit, you're probably going to remove it before the parasite manages to sporulate and become infectious.
Well,
so,
that's good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So if your cat's actively shedding oocysts and you let the poop sit there in the litter box and dry out, the oocysts are going to sporulate and they may enter the environment in dust particles from the litter box. But if you pick up the poop and dispose of it right away, you'll likely get it out of your house before sporulation occurs and it becomes infectious. And also, to protect everyone else in the community, consider wrapping the poop in a plastic bag before you toss it. That prevents those oocysts from making it into the environment and floating around in the air until they land on someone's sandwich.
Still certain Don has the parasite.
No, I do not.
Well, do you know for sure?
Not for sure.
We're gonna talk about rates of infection later. Okay, so now you've got sporulated oocysts, and these can end up in the water, the soil, attached to plant material, etc., where they can easily be ingested by animals. Now, if it makes its way inside a warm-blooded animal, it will slip inside one of the animal's cells and take over the cell's inner machinery. Unlike a lot of other pathogens, toxoplasma can infect a wide range of types of cells. It's not at all picky. Once inside the cell, each sporozoite will eventually mature into a new stage called a tachyzoite, which divides rapidly and is found predominantly during acute infections in the secondary host. So these tachyzoites are going to divide and burst out of the cell and go and infect new cells so that the parasite can multiply within the host.
How does it get in the host?
Yeah, so it starts as the oocyst, and that's shed in the cat's feces into the environment.
So it's airborne.
Well, and then it what has to happen is it has to land on something that is ingested. So it might land on
A piece of grass
that gets eaten. It might land on a little piece of food. It might land in the water that gets drunk.
So it has to be consumed then, not
correct.
And not inhaled.
Correct. I mean, it's...
Okay, so unless you've been eating the cat poo, you might be all right, Dawn.
Definitely did not eat any cat poo. I definitely did not eat any food that was around cat poo.
Well, that's generally a good practice. I mean, it is, you know, it's good...
Probably. I try not to ever.
I was
do
worried
that.
When it was just sniffing the cat poo, because I know you're guilty of that.
No, I'm not guilty of that either. Nor do I eat food that is around cat poo. So I think I'm fairly safe.
I'm feeling better.
But I think
you.
By the end of the show, we will find out.
Indeed. So this tachyzoite stage is all happening inside a secondary host, like a rat or a human. So think of the tachyzoite stage as the stage that's trying to make a bunch of identical copies of itself as fast as it possibly can. So it can spread itself out all over the secondary host body. It wants to be spread all over the body, in the muscles and in the brain. So once they've multiplied sufficiently, the tachyzoites will eventually mature into bradyzoites. We're still inside the secondary host. These divide more slowly and are more typical during chronic low-level infection. So these are going to form cysts, usually in nerve cells or muscle cells, and they can just hang out there and divide slowly for years. So think of the bradyzoite stage as the stealth stage.
And what size are we talking about? What size is the parasite when it's laying somewhat dormant in these cysts?
So it's still really tiny. It's still, you know, maybe 5 micrometers. So, mm-hmm. You know, about the size of a human red blood cell. So itty bitty.
But there's hundreds of them.
Potentially.
And all in individual cysts? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so they would insist. So when the parasite is in this sort of stealth bradyzoite stage, its goal is just to hang out and hide within the host and not cause a lot of damage. So when the host is full of bradyzoites, they probably won't have any noticeable disease symptoms, because the host is really the parasite at this point is just waiting to be eaten by a cat. Okay. So far, all of the division and reproduction that we've been talking about by this parasite is asexual. It's just copying its genome each time and passing it along. For the sexual reproductive phase of its life cycle, Toxoplasma has to find its way inside a cat, which most often happens when the cat consumes the tissue of an infected animal that has either been killed or scavenged. So, when the cat eats part of an infected animal, say, the head of a rodent or a squirrel, it will ingest the cysts embedded in the animal's tissues. And when the cyst reaches the cat's digestive tract, the outer coating is dissolved and the bradyzoites are released. These bradyzoites then invade the epithelial cells of the digestive tract and undergo yet another transformation into merozoites, which produce two different kinds of gametes or sex cells.
Now, why doesn't this happen if a dog eats the squirrel? Why does it have to be a feline? Why does it have to be a cat?
You know, that is such a great question. What is it about the feline system that triggers it to do this? Because animals actually can become infected with Toxoplasma gondii by ingesting these cysts, but it doesn't go into its sexual reproductive phase. It only does that in cats.
Is it a chemical reaction? Something?
Yeah, that would be my hypothesis, right? Is that it would have to do... there would be something going on in terms of chemical signaling that would trigger the parasite to know it's inside a cat and know that it's time to complete the sexual component of its life cycle. I don't know what that is.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. No, it totally is. Okay. So this single-celled organism, it has to keep going through these transformations to accomplish the different stages of its life cycle. So they produce two different types of sex cells or gametes. They're technically not eggs and sperm. So they're just two different types of gametes. And when these two get together, fertilization occurs, oocysts develop, and the cycle starts all over again, with the oocysts exiting the cat, sporulating once they're in contact with the air, and being ingested by a secondary host.
And so this doesn't affect the cat in any way at all?
Sometimes. So typically, the cat that's infected will have zero symptoms. But cats with weak or compromised immune systems like kittens or cats with feline leukemia can develop symptoms, which in severe cases can cause death. So it is possible. Now, interestingly, they only shed oocysts for a few weeks after infection, and then they stop shedding oocysts even if the infection persists. So that sexual reproductive phase just occurs for a couple weeks and then stops. So given that the life cycle of this parasite is so complicated and takes place across at least two different hosts, it's no surprise that it took biologists a long time to unravel the details and fully understand this organism. Toxoplasma gondii was first identified as a new species and given its scientific name in 1908 when it was found in a wild rodent in North Africa. But its complete life cycle, including the sexual reproductive phase in cats, was not fully described until 1970. And I have to drop our first quote here of the episode from J.P. Duby, who wrote a great overview of the history of the research on Toxoplasma gondii in the International Journal for Parasitology. Quote, "It was an experience of a lifetime for me, handling bobcats and ocelots in cages. I was a postdoctoral fellow in Dr. Frenkel's laboratory, and still the memory of one incident is vivid in my mind. My courageous neighbor, who had a pet ocelot, loaned me the animal for testing for oocyst shedding. Three of us, Jack Frenkel, Nancy Miller, she was a biological technician, and myself, were sweating, trying to obtain a blood sample without giving anesthesia from this 15-kilogram ocelot before feeding it tissue cysts. The ocelot shed oocysts, and we returned the animal to its owner." End quote. Now, we usually think about toxoplasma being transmitted by the oocysts and cat feces, a la episode 5 of this season of South Park. Did you guys see that episode?
Not yet.
No.
We might have to watch that tonight. It's important to remember that these oocysts are very resilient and can easily end up in soil or water, where they come in contact with water or food that's consumed. And oocysts are not the only mode of transmission to humans. People can also acquire toxoplasmosis from eating undercooked meat from an infected mammal or bird, which is the same way that cats get infected. But when a person ingests a cyst full of bradyzoites embedded in a piece of meat, they just start reproducing asexually and forming cysts in the human's muscle or brain. This mode of transmission was confirmed by an experiment conducted in France in 1965, where the researchers compared rates of toxoplasmosis infection in children at a sanatorium before and after changing their diet to barely cooked meat. The rate of infection actually rose to 100% after barely cooked lamb was added to the diet.
Ew. That sounds horrible.
Yeah. So, yes, if you're wondering, they did, in fact, serve undercooked meat to children in an institution.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Clearly done before the introduction of institutional review boards on human subjects.
Mm-hmm. So, I have a question.
Yeah, please.
So, we've discussed that it has to be ingested.
Mm-hmm.
So why are pregnant women educated not to, or informed by their doctors, not to clean the litter box while they're pregnant if it's not really, if they don't contract it through airborne, it's through ingestion?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So if you think about it, the particles might be floating around in the air. You don't necessarily have to breathe those in. They might land somewhere on your body, right? And so if they landed on your hands and you ended up preparing food, you might end up getting those dust particles with the oocysts on them in the food. It's also possible that you might get, that some of those particles might get trapped in the mucous membranes of your nose or throat, which then may drain down into your digestive tract. And so, well, it's not technically airborne, that is potentially another way that the particles could make their way into your stomach.
Oh, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
Or licking your fingers right after changing.
I always wash my hands after cleaning the litter box.
I am not surprised. Now, of course, if a human became infected and then were to be eaten by a cat, which is rare but not unheard of, the cysts in your tissues would go on to infect that cat and reproduce sexually to produce more oocysts. Yet another way that toxoplasmosis can be transmitted in humans is from a mother to her unborn fetus, causing something called congenital toxoplasmosis, which can actually be extremely serious, often resulting in fetal death, miscarriage, or damage to the brain and or eyes of the infant. So these are really terrible outcomes and are the reason that pregnant women are advised not to handle a cat's litter box.
Did you say it specifically attacks the eyes of the infant?
It commonly affects the eyes and the brain. Yep. It can affect other systems as well, but those are two that seem to stand out as ones that are major targets. The first described case of congenital toxoplasmosis in modern medical literature was from 1938 at Babies Hospital in New York. The doctors who wrote up the study described the birth of a baby girl who sadly developed seizures 3 days after birth and died after a month. The autopsy consequently confirmed the presence of Toxoplasma gondii in her tissues. Now, the reason that toxoplasmosis is so dangerous in developing fetuses and newborns is that their immune systems are not fully developed, and the parasites multiply too quickly and overwhelm the host. So it's really about rate of replication. They're just making tons and tons and tons of copies, and it's overwhelming the host's immune system. Similarly, toxoplasmosis can sometimes cause severe symptoms in adults who are immunocompromised. For example, organ transplant recipients who might exhibit symptoms associated with brain inflammation like headaches, confusion, and seizures, or sometimes lung issues. For healthy adults, infection is usually asymptomatic or very mild with symptoms similar to the flu. If an immunocompromised person does develop severe symptoms, they can be treated with the antibiotic clindamycin, which is normally used to treat bacterial infections. Now, so this is really interesting, because typically antibacterials would be useless against a eukaryotic parasite like Toxoplasma. But it turns out that Toxoplasma has an extra set of DNA that was likely acquired sometime in its very distant evolutionary past, when its ancestor probably swallowed another bacterium and incorporated its DNA into its own genome.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it swallowed a bacterium and incorporated that bacteria's DNA into its own. And it's not exactly clear what this DNA does, but it does appear to be linked to clindamycin susceptibility. So, very interesting. Now, non-human animals that are infected also typically have mild symptoms, but there's some pretty compelling evidence that their infection permanently alters their behavior. This phenomenon has been studied in rodents, mostly in mice, and in some of the earlier experiments that were conducted, mice were placed into an artificial environment that had cat urine added in specific locations. And mice have really sensitive noses and will instinctually avoid areas where they can smell cat urine. This is true even for mice that have never actually seen a cat. So these studies compared mice that were infected with Toxoplasma to mice that were not infected, and found that the infected mice were significantly more likely to approach the areas where the odor of cat urine was present.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's almost more like it draws them to the cat.
Exactly.
Like makes it easier for the cat to catch them.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is incredible, right? Like, so this parasite is causing its host to change its behavior in a way that makes it more likely to end up in a place where it can complete its life cycle.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy, right? You know, from these data, you know, you could infer that infected mice lose their instinctual fear of cats, a behavioral change that would definitely make them more likely to be caught and eaten by cats, and therefore more likely to deliver the parasite to its definitive host where it can complete its life cycle. Now, later studies showed that the behavioral shift in mice is probably not so specific to cats. Infected mice were shown to overall be more likely to explore areas that are more exposed or areas of the urine where other predators is present. So they may simply become less anxious and more prone to take risks than it being specifically related to cats. But this would still be advantageous to the parasite, since a more generally adventurous mouse is still more likely to end up in a cat's belly. As researcher Laura Knoll puts it, the parasite, quote, clearly manipulates the crap out of the host, end quote.
And so if it does that to the mouse, what does it do to a human when a human has the cysts?
Aha, great question. So the phenomenon is not unique to mice. So it's been studied in other species, and in fact, one of them looked at infected hyena cubs, which were more likely than non-infected cubs to approach lions, and therefore more likely to die from predation by lions. And the phenomenon very likely also extends to humans. So here's where it gets pretty interesting. Numerous correlations have been found between toxoplasmosis infection and behavioral patterns or mental health status in people. All of the following have been found to have a statistically significant correlation with antibodies to Toxoplasma gondii. And of course, if you have antibodies to it, that would indicate current or prior infection, right? So all of these conditions: schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, OCD, major depression, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, rage disorder, and the likelihood of traffic accidents.
That's a strange thing to be thrown in there.
Yeah.
I guess you're more likely to take a risk when you're driving.
Exactly. It seems to be related to risk-taking behavior. Mm. Although there are some subtle effects that differ based on sex. So some research suggests that infection by Toxoplasma gondii makes human biological males more likely to engage in behaviors that might be frowned upon by mainstream society. And biological females are more likely to be more open and socially outgoing. Now, are those behaviors likely to cause a person to be more susceptible to being eaten by a cat? Difficult to say, since the incidence of people being consumed by cats is very small. Nevertheless, you can make the case that the behaviors seen in people infected with Toxoplasma are likely to result in taking more risks or possibly being prone to more accidents. Now, I want to stress that these are all correlational patterns, and correlation does not necessarily equate to causation, but it's still relatively compelling.
I'm feeling kind of weird these days, like I want to take risks and I'm in a haze. I've been running the trails at the edge of the city, hoping to encounter a great big kitty. Is it weird, you think? My cougar obsession? Well, it's kind of new and it's got me guessing. Even though I feel all right, I think I might have some parasites. Well, Toxoplasma is in my brain. It might sound bad, but it's a mild strain. We'll play this game until the end, and if a cougar eats me, the parasite wins.
So how many humans are there walking around in the world with their behavior potentially being impacted by this parasite?
I'd say at least one in this room.
I don't know.
Well, it turns out it varies depending on where you live. So in the U.S., the most current estimate is that about 11% of the population is infected. And the rate of infection has been slowly declining in the last decade or so.
Why do you think it's been declining?
Yeah, that is a great question. I mean, it could be just related to overall increases in hygiene.
And better litter awareness?
Yeah,
awareness.
I was going to say litter awareness. And now we have the robot litter boxes. So you're really not even touching the litter anymore. Yeah.
Absolutely. No, Dawn, that's a great point. And I hadn't thought of that, that there are these sort of advances in, shall we say, litter box technology. That whether it's the litter itself or the box itself, that means we don't have to handle as much litter directly.
Because even if it's not a robot litter box, sometimes it's just a liner that you take out and you don't scoop. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you just literally pick the whole thing.
The parasite doesn't seem to have a preference in host. Does
correct.
It just ends up on grass and whatever. Host or whatever eats the grass, and then
any bird or mammal that eats it has the potential to get infected.
But only the cat, only a rodent can give it to a cat.
No. You could give it to a cat if you got eaten by your cat.
So if a cat eats
only
a mouse,
its life cycle if it's eaten by a cat. Its life cycle stops.
Right. If it's eaten.
So if you were to eat a squirrel. That had been contaminated by the parasite, you would probably still be okay.
Yeah.
Unless you got eaten by your cat.
No, you wouldn't be okay. You just wouldn't. Your poo would be okay.
But what if a cat eats an infected, say, lizard?
Well, cold-blooded animals don't seem to be.
Okay. What about a bird?
Bird, yes.
So if a cat ate a bird, it's the same thing as if it ate a rodent.
Yeah, if the bird were infected, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do cats show any type of symptoms when they've been infected or are in an active infection stage?
Well, typically, if the cat is healthy, no. Or it might just be mild symptoms. But if the cat is immunocompromised in some way, so, if it's a very, very young cat, a young kitten, or if it's an elderly cat, or if it's a cat that has some underlying disease, then it might become sick.
Like humans.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The other factor that might have to do with why the rate is going down in the United States is remember that the other way that you can contract it is from undercooked meat. And there have been lots of improvements in our supply chain for meat. So it's a lot less likely now to have pathogens in meat.
So the heat simply kills it.
Or it's not in there to begin with.
Well, I mean, I guess cooking the meat.
Cooking the meat definitely kills it.
Bringing it up to a certain temperature.
Exactly.
Is killing the parasite.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is why I didn't cook your chicken that I put in your casserole today, just to make sure that we retain some possibility that you might become infected from this meal. Now, globally, the percentage of people that get infected is much higher. It's between 25 and 33%, depending on which sources you look at. In some areas, the rate of infection is above 85%. Now, interestingly, cat ownership does not appear to be a risk factor for toxoplasmosis, but exposure to crowded and unsanitary conditions is. So this is great news to cat lovers, but maybe not such great news if you live somewhere where resources are limited and people have to crowd to get.
Or what is the island that has so many cats? That street cats? Is it somewhere in Greece?
There's lots of cities that have a high number of street cats.
I just wonder if those cities have higher.
That's a great
instances.
Question. I would be curious to look that up. For sure.
Because there's probably dried cat poop
everywhere. Yes.
Yeah. And nobody cleans that up, you wouldn't think.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because they're street cats.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. All right. So at this point, we're going to take a little break because I'm going to bring up your surprise dish, which is a dessert dish. And then I will give you some opportunity to share any closing thoughts or ask any additional questions.
Eyes closed.
Okay, eyes are closed. I'm excited.
All right, you can open your eyes.
Oh, look at that.
Nice.
I'm excited
too.
Can you describe what you're eating?
Yes, definitely. It is
definitely some cat turds.
Yes. Definitely some chocolatey looking cat turds and I believe vanilla ice cream with caramel sauce.
Yes.
So delicious.
Yeah, how did I get the cat turds? So they look pretty convincing.
They look very so convincing. Mm-hmm. I'm a little scared of them.
No.
So
a biscotti.
Yeah. So as you enjoy those, any closing thoughts on Toxoplasma gondii or your meal?
Well, I was wondering.
Uh-huh.
What would happen if, say, Vegas, our cat.
Yep.
He doesn't have the opportunity to eat any rodents, except for, you know, the Beanie Babies, as we discussed. But what if he were to go outside and eat some of the grass that has the Toxoplasmosis gondii on it?
Oh, yeah. So if he ate some oocysts that were out in the environment?
Yeah. So if it skipped the stage of the rodent, would he still get infected with the cysts?
So that is a really good question. I'm going to have to look that one up, Ben, because I think that is a really good question. I don't know.
Yeah, because cats do eat a lot of grass.
Mm-hmm.
They do, for sure. And they can also if they eat something that they scavenge, right? So if he were to find a dead mole or something out there and eat a little bit of it, then that could be another way that he could end up getting it.
But does it actually have to go through the other host, like the mole or the mouse?
Right. That's the question I'm gonna have to go look at and research.
Sorry, my mouth is full. This is delicious.
No, that's okay.
More questions.
take your time.
During our break, Ben was talking and wondering if there's a difference between the toxoplasmosis being found in large breed cats versus like a house cat, like
a wild cat
versus house cats.
Yeah, so that's a great question too. There are different strains, but I don't know that it's species specific more than it's geographically specific. So in certain geographic regions, like certain strains are more common than in others.
So are there any recommendations for precautions to take when cleaning out your litter box? Are we supposed to wear face masks or gloves, or is it, or is that just for pregnant women?
Yeah. So in general, if you are cautious about hygiene when you're cleaning your cat's litter box, it probably shouldn't be a big deal. You know, that which would include, you know, making sure that you dispose of the stuff in a plastic bag, and that you wash your hands thoroughly after you've been handling anything related to the litter box, and that you have the litter box in an area where it's not going to be creating dust that has a likelihood of ending up on something that you're going to eat. And then, of course, there's that other piece that if you can catch it quickly enough, so if you catch the poo before it dries out, it probably won't be infectious because the oocysts won't have time to sporulate.
Yeah, I was going to say a daily cleaning would probably be best.
Yeah.
Especially if you have multiple cats.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, is it actually the lack of moisture when you say the feces drying out? Is it from the lack of moisture? Is it because of the duration of time? Or is it just that it spreads easier once it's dry?
Well, I think it's both. So I think it's both things going on. So part of it is the sporulation doesn't occur until the feces are exposed to air. So when they're exposed to air, then the sporulation process can be initiated. And it takes a little while for that to complete. In addition, so when it's been out in the air for a while, it gets dry. Right, when it's inside the cat, it stays nice and moist.
Sure.
We don't have to go into details about why. So in addition to it being exposed to air and therefore drying out, the drier it gets, also the more powdery it gets, and
easier for it to move around.
Yeah. So I think both things are happening there. Great. Well, you don't have to have any other questions. We can close this up.
I think we're just so involved in eating our dessert.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to hear that. So I used a number of sources to inform this episode. I want to highlight a few that were extremely helpful. I got some interesting tidbits from Carl Zimmer's book, Parasite Rex, about toxoplasma's influence on behavior and also its susceptibility to clindamycin. For the life cycle, I leaned heavily on The Life Cycle of Toxoplasma gondii Viewed Using Animations by Marcia Attias et al. In the Journal of Parasite Vectors. I also used an article called Behavioral Biology of Toxoplasma gondii Infection by Wenheng Tong et al., which was a great review of impacts of this parasite on behavior. And, of course, Joe Doobie's article on the history of the research on Toxoplasma's life cycle. I'd like to offer my thanks again to my guests, Ben Messier, Tanya Messier, and Dawn Stafford. Thank you again for joining me for this episode.
It was so much fun.
Yes.
So much
fun.
Thank
you for having us.
You guys were awesome guests. And thank you, listeners, for joining me and my friends on Worst Guest Ever. So, I double-checked a couple things after we recorded this episode. First off, I was sort of wrong when I said that a cyst inside of a secondary host tissue contains what I implied was a single bradyzoite. Actually, the bradyzoites continue to divide slowly within a cyst, so that ultimately the cyst has multiple bradyzoites inside of it. So, one cyst can contain multiple bradyzoites or multiple toxoplasma cells. Also, I looked up what happens when a cat ingests oocysts from the environment. So apparently this can indeed happen, and when it does, the parasite goes ahead and goes through the sexual part of its life cycle, just like it would if the cat ate a cyst containing bradyzoites. So, interestingly, no matter how it gets into a cat, toxoplasma goes into the same phase of its life cycle to produce oocysts that are deposited in the cat's feces. If you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Our theme song is an artistic collaboration with piano music composed and performed by Jan May, vocals by the multi-talented Dr. Julia Willis, and lyrics by yours truly. Additional music for the intro is a piece called Video Cat Jazz by Parr.